Well, guys, if...
Are any of you military buffs, war buffs? You guys like that? Okay, few of you.
If so, well, this chapter, might be kind of right up your alley, maybe. Now, I recognize for some that the history of war or armed conflict and such may not be all that interesting to you. In fact, some may find war and the inevitable loss of life a bit reprehensible, a horrible subject to think about. So it might interest us to realize that God chose in His Word to include histories and details of things like war and bloodshed and conflict. And with that in mind, there is an essential fact that we kind of all need to keep in mind as we approach a chapter like this. We need to know and remember that God promised Abraham and Jacob and Moses and Joshua that He would give His people a promised land. Yes? You've all heard the term, right? Promised land. It's fairly well known. This was what God promised to give to His people. A place to call their own. A place where they might be the upright people of God that He intended them to be. Protected in some respects from the evils of this world. And where they might be lights in a dark place. That is what God wished them to be and what God wished for them. And He led them to that promised land and gave them military victories over the pagan nations that inhabited it, and even gave them specific dimensions of that promised land. Now, understand, up until this point in Israel's history, where we find ourselves tonight in chapter 8, the Israelites had really only possessed a relatively small portion of what God had given them. But under David and a little bit of Solomon after him, for the first time in the history of the nation, Israel will conquer the full extent of the promised land that God had promised them many years prior. Now, you might be wondering, well, what exactly were the dimensions? Maybe you hadn't heard about that before. What was the dimensions of the promised land that God wanted to give them? Well, I'm glad you asked. I want you to listen to what God said to Abraham all the way back in Genesis chapter 15, verse 18. And by the way, all of these references that I'll mention tonight are in your outlines. So if I move a little faster than you are able to flip over to them, you will be able to go and check those out, make sure I'm not lying to you, make sure those things are in fact what we're talking about. But Genesis 15, 18, listen to what God says. It says, "On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates.'" Now, that gives us a little bit of definition as far as some boundaries. At the time of this chapter, okay, historically speaking, matter of fact, if you have an actual, book-like Bible with you tonight, I know those are getting rarer as everyone goes to their phone, but if you've got a Bible with you and it's got maps in the back, you're welcome to, because we're going to be looking at a lot of places in tonight that it might be helpful for you maybe to get a picture of this. But in 2 Samuel chapter 8, the Israelites, as I said, had still not possessed all of the area that God promised. So here we have, from the river of Egypt in the south, okay, that is, that's not the Nile. I know some people read river of Egypt and they assume the Nile. Actually, this is a river. It's actually called the Wadi of Egypt. It's a river, and it is about 50 to 60 miles south of Gaza. There's a name we all know right now, right? So that's kind of give you a little bit of an idea. So from there, north all the way to the Euphrates River, which is deep in modern-day Syria, almost, maybe even all the way to Turkey. So we're talking about quite a ways, okay? So that gives you a little bit of north and south of what God said was the promised land, okay? But in Deuteronomy 11, verse 24, God gives a bit more east-west detail to these dimensions. Listen to what God says there. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads shall be yours. Your border will be from the wilderness to Lebanon, from the river Euphrates, as far as the western sea. Okay? Now, here, first of all, you notice here another reference to the Euphrates River, which, as we've already seen, would be the northern border of the Promised Land, of course, far north of the territory they had in at the time of this chapter. But the Euphrates River, and again, if you've got a little map there, you will see it, the Euphrates River kind of curves like this and starts to come down, okay, and actually meanders its way all the way into the modern day land of Iraq, okay, and it would then be the eastern border for Israel, or as it's simply mentioned here, the wilderness. If you've ever seen pictures of that part of the world, that is an apt description. There's nothing out there, man, okay. And so, whereas Lebanon and the Western Sea, we call it the Mediterranean, that forms the western dimensions, okay? The western border of the Promised Land. And this area along the Mediterranean coast, including modern-day Lebanon, all the way down the coast to that river of Egypt that I mentioned before, which empties into the Mediterranean, that was the area at this time that was controlled by the Philistines. I know that's a name you all know if you've been through these studies with us. But guys, all of that, everything that I just mentioned and described was what God had given to the Jews, to the Israelites as the promised land. And now that God's king is on the throne, David, and God's king was setting up God's kingdom, the enemies of God's kingdom had to be dealt with. Understand, guys, the battles and things that we're going to read about tonight are not just land disputes, okay? David here is basically the new Joshua, who returns Israel to that unfinished, God-given task of conquering the Promised Land, of driving out of the Promised Land those who were against God, who were against God's people. And all of the nations that David is going to defeat in this chapter, over the prior 300 years or so, had set themselves up as the enemies of God, had set themselves up as the enemies of God's people. So he's not just conquering the Promised Land because they're trying to expand their land. He was eliminating the enemies of God, people who were against him, okay? So, with that, a little bit of that background in mind, let's jump into chapter 8, where we're going to see David conquering all of the nations that were surrounding Israel. At this time, Israel kind of, their area of land was kind of right in the middle. They were surrounded on almost all sides, okay? And so David begins conquering those nations. Begin with me there in verse 1. Now, after this, it came about that David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. And David took control of the chief city from the hand of the Philistines. So, what is David's very first foray into securing the land God had promised? Well, he began with the Philistines. And actually, like I said, if you've been in our studies through 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, you understand probably why he started here. These are the guys who have been the biggest thorn in the side of Israel for quite a while now. But who exactly are the Philistines? As I mentioned, they occupied the majority of the Mediterranean coast, okay? Which is, of course, to the west of Israel, where they're, you know, more in the heartland there. And ethnically, they were actually quite distinct from Israel. They were not closely related. Actually, the Philistines were most closely related to the Egyptians, okay? At some point, they had sailed to this area. They had planted a colony that had grown to prominence on the coast prior to or perhaps during the days of Israel's judges. So all of the different individuals detailed in the book of Judges, probably around that time frame. And by the time that Samson, you all know him, right? Guy with the long hair. Samson, by the time he came around, which is Judges chapters 13 through 16, the Philistines were a persistent, constant enemy of Israel. In the days of Samuel, you might remember from our early studies in 1 Samuel, they defeated Israel. Remember, they captured the Ark of the Covenant, and they took it home to kind of parade it around, and God, of course, humbled them, sending the tumors upon their bodies and an infestation of mice until they gave the Ark back. In fact, constant attacks from the Philistines were part of what caused the Israelites to eventually say, "Give us a king, give us a king." Remember that? They wanted someone who would lead them into battle. Just like the Philistines had, they wanted something like that. And of course, the king they demanded was Saul. Unfortunately, his primary job was to deliver them from the Philistine threat. As you know, he never accomplished that. In fact, at the end of 1 Samuel, he died in battle with the Philistines at the hands of the Philistines. And then the Philistines ended up occupying much of what had been Israel's in the north and even some in the central area there. The next king, of course, was David. And that was God's chosen king. That was the one that God wanted. And David distinguished himself in battle with the Philistines, basically by always beating them. Every time David was involved against the Philistines, they always won. And of course, his first battle against a Philistine was the biggest, baddest one of them all, and that was Goliath, which again, a name we're all familiar with. And so even though David was just a teenager at the time, God enabled him to take down Goliath with just a sling and one stone fortuitously buried right in Goliath's head. And of course, since then, God has consistently given David victory over the Philistines. In the fifth chapter of 2 Samuel, we saw him defeat the Philistines again, pushing them out of that central and northern territory they had taken from Saul and pushing them back to the coast, back to where they had been before. Well, as you can see here, guys, in verse 1, David immediately takes the battle to the Philistine homeland. Up until this point, every time they have fought the Philistines, it's been in Israel. It's been in the land that they had, okay? David is taking the fight to them. And his intention here is to eliminate the threat of the Philistines once and for all. Notice that verse 1 does not say that David merely defeated them. It says that he subdued them, okay? That Hebrew word translated there as subdued is a very strong word. It means complete humiliation. That's what was happening here. And David completely defeated the Philistine nation, crippling them for good. In fact, we're told here that David took their chief city. Okay, and you might remember the Philistines had like five main city-states, right, in their area. And this was their main city that David took, their capital city, so to speak. A parallel account of this fight, this battle in 1 Chronicles 18 tells us that the city was Gath. That name might be familiar to you because that is in fact the hometown of Goliath, where Goliath came from. And so David conquered this city so completely that he took control of the Philistine nation. Think about it, guys. This would be like China or Russia invading and taking control of Washington, D.C. That would it shockwaves through the whole country, right? And that is, in fact, what happened here. In fact, David's conquest of the Philistines here is so overwhelming that while they will occasionally kind of reappear in Israel's history, in the future they are so weak that they will never pose a threat to Israel again. That's how decisive this battle is. However, The Philistines were not the only ones that David went to war with, as you can see from the beginning of verse 2 there. He defeated Moab and measured them with the line, making them lie down on the ground. And he measured two lines to put to death and one full line to keep alive. And the Moabites became servants to David, bringing tribute. So, as you can see, right, after the Philistines, David turns his sights to the Moabites. Now, the Moabites, where they were at, is like southeast of Jerusalem, basically, on the other side of the Dead Sea. I don't know if you have your maps open there or if you already have that in your mind, that picture, but that's where the land of Moab was. Now, unlike the Philistines, the Moabites were actually relatively close kinsmen to the Israelites. But while they were biologically related, the Moabites were consistently hostile to the Israelites. In the days of Moses, when the Israelites were on their journey from Egypt to the Promised Land, the Israelites requested passage through their land so that they could enter the Promised Land, and the Moabites refused. A little bit later in Israel's history, in Numbers 25, they sent Moabite women into the nation of Israel to seduce the men away from their wives so that they would turn their hearts to the worship of their foreign gods. And honestly, that plot almost worked. There were a lot of dead men in Israel by the time that was over. Also, you might remember, in Numbers 22 through 24, King Barak of Moab hired a prophet by the name of Balaam. How many of you know Balaam's name? Okay, and what he wanted Balaam to do was to issue a curse against the nation of Israel. But contrary to the king's plan, Balaam found that as he began to speak this curse against Israel, the words that came out of his mouth were actually altered by God into a blessing upon Israel. In Numbers chapter 24, verse 17, we are given part of that prophetic blessing from Balaam's mouth. I want you to hear the words of it, because it's kind of cool considering what we're looking at. This is what he said. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and it shall crush the forehead of Moab. Now, obviously, that's not what the king wanted said, obviously, but this is what God made him say. Well, guys, in 2 Samuel chapter 8, where we are tonight, we meet that star. We meet that scepter. It is David. It is David. And as you see here in verse 2, he destroyed the Moabite nation. Now, amongst all of this, you know, Moabite negativity, there were some remarkable exceptions, okay? For instance, there was a Moabite woman by the name of Ruth. How many of you are familiar with Ruth, right? There's a whole Old Testament book written about her, okay? And this Moabite woman turned from her false gods, accepted Israel's God as hers, and married a godly Israelite man by the name of Boaz. Again, you can read all of that in the book of Ruth, but did you know that she was in fact David's great-great-grandmother? And so you see some of the connections there. That probably explains why in those days when David was on the run from King Saul and basically trying to keep out of Saul's way so Saul couldn't kill him, you might remember that David received help and a place to hide from the king of Moab. It's probably because David had, you know, there's some relative connections there. That's in 1 Samuel 22. In fact, we're told that David actually left his parents, who had been traveling with David, when he returned to the land of Israel. He left his parents with the king of Moab. Now, I do not know if this is true or not. Okay, since it's not found in the Bible, obviously, we can't stand on it as absolutely true. But ancient Jewish commentaries on this passage claim that at some point after David leaving his parents there, the king of Moab murdered them, killed them. If that is accurate, it explains a little bit of what's happening here in verse 2, where it says that in conquering the Moabites, David, it says, measured them with the line, making them lie down on the ground. And he measured two lines to put to death and one full line to keep alive. Now, I don't fully know exactly what all of this looked like. Apparently, the people he captured, he had them lay on the ground, and in some fashion, he measured them with a line or with a rope. I don't know if like all the tall people died and all the short people. I have no idea how that worked. But in short, David killed 2/3 of all the Moabites. Okay, that's kind of the long and short of this. And those who lived and died were determined somehow with that rope. Okay? Now, I understand that that sounds incredibly harsh. By the look on some of your faces right now, I can tell you're thinking, oh my gosh, that just seems so mean. That's so cruel. Well, guys, before we make any moral judgments about this, first of all, we should note that in this chapter, all of David's actions here are considered good. Okay? It seems everything that God's doing or David's doing here appears to be approved by God. Okay? And again, we have to remember that the Moabites were occupying part of the promised land that God had given to the Israelites, and that God had asked, that God had told the Israelites to remove. And these Moabites had resisted David's kingship. They didn't welcome him. Of course, in the days of Joshua, all the Moabites would have died. They would have been completely wiped out if Joshua and the Israelites then had actually gotten to dealing with them. But instead, here you'll notice that David left enough Moabites alive so that they could keep the land occupied, work the farms, right, and the ranches and all those things that were there, and bring tribute to David, who was now king of the land that they lived in. But he killed so many of them that they were never again a threat to the nation of Israel. Like the Philistines, from this point forward, Moab is never going to be a serious threat to Israel. Now, again, guys, I get that some people recoil, okay, when they read things like this that seem to be approved of, maybe even condoned by God. But do we understand that the same is going to be true with Jesus? Did you ever think of it that way? You know? One day when Jesus returns to this earth, and he is returning, amen, he is coming back. When he returns to establish his millennial kingdom, his thousand-year kingdom on this earth, all of the people who refuse to submit to Jesus' rule will be destroyed. It's called the Battle of Armageddon. You've probably read about it in the book of Revelation, okay? Jesus is the rightful king, not just of the promised land, like David, but of all creation itself. And I'm not saying David and Jesus are the same here. David's just, he's just a man. But when God is setting up a kingdom, there are consequences for those who reject him. Okay? And the outcome for Israel here was that the surviving Moabites became David's subjects, bringing tribute to the king, which would serve to strengthen God's people, to strengthen and build the kingdom of God. Which brings us to another group of people. These ones we might not be quite so familiar with. The Zobahites. How many of you are really versed in Zobahite history? Yeah, nobody. Okay, pick up with me at verse 3. Then David defeated Hadad-Ezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah, as he went to restore his rule at the river. So, here we are introduced to that nation, Zobah. Okay? This was a very powerful Arabian kingdom far to the north of Israel. It's past Damascus and Syria, you know, that area that we even know today. This here is really only the second time that the nation of Zobah will be mentioned in the Bible. And at this time, the king of Zobah was a man with an interesting name. I don't know if I'm saying it exactly right, but this is my best shot at it. Hadad-Ezer, okay? And we're told that Hadad-Ezer was on his way to restore his rule at the river. Now, the river in that area would be the Euphrates River that I talked about a little bit ago, okay? And in some fashion, maybe even by the hand of David, we're not exactly told, his control and influence of the area around the Euphrates River there in Syria was lessening for some reason. So this king, Hadad-Ezer, is on his way to the Euphrates River to try and shore that up. He's trying to build up what's weak, okay? On the way, though, David confronts him and defeats him. Verse 4 describes what happened. David captured from him 1,700 horsemen and 20,000 foot soldiers. And David hamstrung the chariot horses, but reserved enough of them for 100 chariots. So, David takes most, if not all, of the armies and chariots and horses captive. Okay? And then it says that David hamstrung the chariot horses, except for 100 of them. So what's going on here? Right? Why is David doing this? I understand this is, for those of you that really love animals, this might make you really kind of cringe just thinking about this happening. And it's not a pretty thing to think about. But basically, hamstringing a horse involves cutting a tendon in it's right in its hoof or knee, either place, and it basically leaves the horse slightly crippled. Okay? Now, this would leave the horse perfectly suitable for agricultural use. But as you might imagine, it completely removes the possibility of the horse being used militarily, pulling chariots and so forth. And so that's what, I mean, horses in those days were like the tanks of today. So if a king had a lot of horses and a lot of chariots, they were powerful militarily. I mean, you can see right here that David had they captured 1,700 horsemen, 20,000 foot soldiers. There's a lot of people and animals and chariots going on here. And so that's what David did. He basically removing some of the weapons of war. Okay? But you do kind of have to admit that this seems an odd thing to do. Purposely disabling most of these weapons of war that you just received. One might think, well, come on, David, couldn't this have been kind of helpful for you? Kind of useful? You could have had way more than just 100 chariots with horses. Well, we actually have an answer to why David does this. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, this is where God is giving Moses his law, the law. He gave Moses some very specific commands about any kings of Israel in the future. Okay? And we talked about this before, but the kings were forbidden by God from acquiring many horses. The kings were not allowed. Now, why in the world would God care about how many horses somebody has? Well, here's the thing, guys. Many kings, as you might imagine, found their confidence in their horses, in their chariots. In that day, like I said, that is what made you powerful in that ancient world. Okay? And that was something that they trusted in. They believed we can go to war. We are strong. We're powerful. Because look what we have. But Israel's kings, by contrast, were not to acquire many horses and chariots so that they would not place their sense of security in their military strength. Instead, they would place their confidence where? In God. Absolutely. Did you know that David actually wrote about this very thing in a worship psalm? Right? Listen to what he says. Psalm chapter 20, verse 7. David says, "Some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. That's exactly what is happening here. Of course, Zobah had many horses, many chariots. Israel probably only had a couple. Remember before when Saul was king, there was one. That was it. That was all that existed, was the one for Saul. This was not something that the Israelites had access to much yet. The Philistines and others kind of kept it from them. But Zobah had a bunch. And how well did that work out for them? Yeah, it didn't do them any good at all. Why? Because they were fighting God. They were fighting God's people. Okay? They were fighting God's king. When God's on your side, guys, horses and chariots don't really matter. Neither do tanks or any other thing that human beings may depend on. David was being a king after God's own heart here, wasn't he? He was trusting in God for the victory. So he turned down the horses. He turned down the chariots that he acquired. He kept 100 of them. Remember, they didn't hardly have any. So he kept 100, but he basically turned over all of the rest of them to the Israelites to use for agricultural purposes, to use in all sorts of other ways. Now, you might think, well, what in the world does that have to do with us, right? I mean, we don't have chariots. I doubt do any of you have horses? Well, no horses, okay? So what does this mean to us? Well, where do we place our trust? I mean, let's just take it, first of all, let's just take it at the level of our country. Where does our country, where does our nation place its trust? Military, that's one of them, right? Wealth, right? Ingenuity of its people, right? And then maybe some other things, but right? That's why, you know, we feel confident. We're a strong nation, and that is where we have put our trust. But more importantly, as individuals, can I ask you, where do you put your trust? Because you may not have a horse and chariot at home, but guess what? We all got our horses and chariots at home. In other words, we've all got those things that we put our hope in, our trust in. Maybe it's your great paying job or the future of a great paying job after school or something, right? Maybe it's, I don't know. Maybe whatever it might be, there are things where we as Christians are tempted to put our trust in for our sense of security and safety in the future. To this, God would say, no horses, no chariots. Trust in me. Trust in me. Guys, the only true security that you and I have from our enemies in this earth or anywhere else is our God and Savior Jesus Christ. Amen? That's it. And guess what? We need no other. Period. Our God is sufficient for us to put all our hope and trust in Him. We do not have to put our trust in anything this world might offer. Okay? So, with God's help, David has conquered the Philistines, right? He has conquered the Moabites. He has conquered the Zobahites. But this stirred up another hornet's nest. Okay? The Arameans. You see, to reach Zobah, David had to pass through territory that was controlled by the Arameans. Okay? These were the Syrians of Damascus. Okay? And the city of Damascus is about, 25 miles south or so of Zobah. And the Arameans were a powerful ally of Hadad-Ezer. So look at verse 5 with me. Look what happens here. When the Arameans of Damascus came to help Hadad-Ezer, king of Zobah, David killed 22,000 Arameans. So, huge number of Syrians, Arameans, came to help Hadad-Ezer, but like all of the others that David had encountered, it did not make much of a difference. David killed 22,000 of them as well. Verse 6 continues, then David put garrisons among the Arameans of Damascus, and the Arameans became servants to David, bringing tribute. Now, some of you might know this, maybe some of you don't. Garrisons are basically military outposts, okay? In other words, David did not have enough people. He didn't have enough people in Israel to occupy all of the territories that he's taken right now. And so he took what was left of the Arameans, and he forcibly put them under his rule, and then he left some military behind to enforce it. And these new servants to the king had the same job that the Moabites did, bringing tribute to Israel. They were to enrich the Israelite nation since David now ruled over them. But why was David doing this? At least that was my first thought when I read this. I mean, isn't it kind of risky, right? Leaving some of your enemies alive? Couldn't they later, somewhere down the road, you know, after a generation or two, you know, kind of upset about what you did before, couldn't they rise up? Well, from a human point of view, yes, that is risky, okay? But as we have already seen, who is David trusting in for his victories here? He's trusting in God, absolutely. Not trusting his military, he's not trusting the horses and chariots or anything else. And David was trusting in God to preserve those victories as well. Look at the end of verse 6. Look what it says there. And the Lord helped David wherever he went. See, everything here that's happening, everything we have read, has been God helping David. And guys, David was very aware of this. David knew that he was outgunned in these battles. None of these nations that he has been going up against were smaller or less militarily advanced than Israel. Israel was like, you know, a bunch of people with rocks and pitchforks, right? And compared to the militaries of these other nations. And yet, God helped David everywhere he went. David knew that unless God intervened, unless God came to the rescue, he was toast, man. He knew that apart from the Lord's strength and intervention, he could defeat none of these people. So he knew that his trust had to lie in God's hands. And so his actions in these military campaigns were based on that. Some of them might make us scratch our heads, but I think they all are based in his trust in God. Now, since we're talking about the nations that David conquered with God's help, I want to cover the last one that's mentioned here, even if it is a little bit out of order, and that is the Edomites. Jump a few verses down with me, if you would. Go to verse 13 of our chapter, and let's read right there. So David made a name for himself when he returned from killing 18,000 Arameans. Now you might read that and go, wait a minute, I just thought it was 22,000. Well, this was not just a battle that happened in one day. So the initial battle that David had killed 22,000. Later, there was another 18,000 that died, okay? So David made a name for himself when he returned from killing 18,000 Arameans in the Valley of Salt. He put garrisons in Edom. In all Edom he put garrisons. And all the Edomites became servants to David, and the Lord helped David wherever he went. Now, let me kind of paint this, because it can feel a little confusing here as to what's happening. First of all, similar to the Moabites, the Edomites were relatives of the Israelites. Okay, Jacob, of course, is one of the fathers, one of the patriarchs of Israel. Do you remember Jacob had a half-brother, didn't he? His name was Esau. Okay, and Esau was the father of the Edomites. Now, at first, in what we've been reading previously, David was leaving the Edomites alone. He hadn't even got to them yet, right? He hadn't dealt with them yet, and that's why they hadn't been mentioned yet. But the Edomites didn't leave David alone. While David was fighting in the north, right, fighting Zobah, fighting the Arameans, the Edomites attacked Israel from the south. In fact, guys, Psalm 60 was a worship song that David wrote of this very battle. Think about that, right? We might think that war and things, that conflict like that shouldn't even, you know, be brought up as Christians. And yet here he's writing a worship song about it. But can I read to you? First of all, I want to read to you just the heading. Have you noticed in reading the Psalms that sometimes they'll have a little heading before it? Not the chapter 60 or anything, but there'll actually be a little description or who the song was for or what instruments are to be used. Those were all part of what was translated. Well, I want you to hear the heading of Psalm 60. It says, "For the choir director," makes sense, right? "According to Shushan Udath," I don't know what that means, "a miktam of David, to teach, when he struggled with Aram Naharaim and Aram Zobah, and Joab returned and smote 12,000 of Edom in the Valley of Salt." So we're dealing with the same time frame that we're looking at. And he wrote this psalm as a prayer for God's help in the middle of these battles. David at this point has now been forced to fight two armies in the north and another army in the south. Any military person will tell you that is not good. That is bad news, okay? And as you are going to see, those victories were not easy. At times it looked like David was going to lose and Israel was going to be destroyed. And David here, and I love this because he's like you and me. He's not a superhero, okay? David was wrestling with whether his trust in the Lord was enough or whether it was misplaced. I want you to hear David's honest words from Psalm 60. Listen to what he says. "Oh God, you have rejected us. You have broken us. You have been angry. Oh, restore us. You have made the land quake. You have split it open. Heal its breaches, for it totters. Who will bring me into the besieged city? Who will lead me to Edom? Have not you yourself, O God, rejected us? And will you not go forth with our armies, O God?" Does that not sound like David's having a little crisis of faith here? Right? David could see that between the Zobahites and the Arameans and now the Edomites, to his eyeballs, they were going to be destroyed. That's what David could see. And he is terrified, because if that's true, then maybe God has rejected them. Even though David put his trust in God, maybe God's rejected them. But I want you to listen to his final words of that psalm. He says, "Oh, give us help against the adversary, for deliverance by man is in vain. Through God we shall do valiantly, for it is He who will tread down our adversaries." I love this. Now, some might read that and go, dang, David's kind of schizophrenic, man. He's like all over the place. No, absolutely not. This is real life. Okay, this is not David sitting in his conservatory penning songs. No, this is David on the battlefield crying out to God honestly. That's what we see. But by the time he got to the end of his crying out to God, where had he come? He had come right back to, "I will trust God. I will trust Him." No matter how it appeared to David's eyes, he knew their only hope was God. And so he doubles down on his faith in God. And what happened? Well, the end of verse 14 probably obviously gave it away, but from a parallel account of these battles, it's found in 1 Chronicles chapter 18, verse 12, we find that Joab, who was the commander of David's army that was fighting the Zobahites and the Arameans in the north, he sent his brother Abishai with soldiers to fight the Edomites in the south. When Abishai and this kind of small group of soldiers got down there, they killed 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt, just by themselves. And then, after Joab defeated those other two nations in the north, he went south, joined his brother, and killed another 12,000 Edomites. And as with the other nations, you'll notice David left garrisons with the defeated Edomites, and they too became servants to David. And guys, why was all of this possible? No, because of what it says there at the end of verse 14. The Lord helped David everywhere he went. Yeah, there were trials. These battles we're reading about, I mean, on the surface we might think that David just shows up in the land of the Philistines and they all just laid down and handed over their weapons and it was all just easy and pretty and nobody ever died. No, these were trials, man. These were hardships. They were troubled here, but God never rejected his people. David was afraid that might be the case because it looked like things were not going so great, but God never rejected his people. It just felt that way to David in his fear in the moment. But his trust and faith in God was well placed, and God gave them the victory against overwhelming odds. So, what would become of all this tribute? There's a lot of tribute coming in now, isn't there? Right? We got the Moabites, we got the Arameans, we got the Edomites at a minimum, and there's actually others, as we'll see in a moment. But what's going to happen with all this? Well, David brought the wealth of those nations into Jerusalem. And guys, that happened two different ways. Okay, there's the easy way, and there was the hard way. Okay, we'll start with the hard way. Read verses 7 and 8 with me. David took the shields of gold, which were carried by the servants of Hadad-Ezer, and brought them to Jerusalem. From Betah and from Berothai, cities of Hadad-Ezer, King David also took a very large amount of bronze. Key words here, guys, are the words David took. Okay? In other words, these very valuable spoils of war, right? Gold, bronze, this is some valuable stuff. They were not being offered up humbly and willingly by defeated Hadad-Ezer, okay? They were forcibly taken, okay? Obviously, some of these people, even after they were defeated, were not willing to lay down and be the servants of God's people. But due to the strength of Israel's God, did they have a choice? No, they had no choice at all. But there were others who responded differently, okay? This is so cool to me. I hope this is cool to you. If it's not cool to you, it's still cool to me, okay? Beginning in verse 9, we are going to be introduced to another king whose reaction to David is quite different, right? The Philistines, the Edomites, the Moabites, Zobahites, the Arameans all chose to go to war against David. They all wanted to fight him. And as a result, they were destroyed, okay? Not everyone took the same tack. Look at verse 9. Now, when Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David defeated all the army of Hadad-Ezer, Toi sent Joram, his son, to King David to greet him and bless him because he had fought against Hadad-Ezer and defeated him. For Hadad-Ezer had been at war with Toi, and Joram brought with him articles of silver, of gold, and of bronze. So, this guy, he didn't want to go to war against David. Instead, what did he choose to do? Welcome David. He chose to bless David. Now, Hamath, okay, is a city that was near Hadad-Ezer's kingdom. And Toi, as we just read, the king of Hamath, was often at war with Hadad-Ezer. This was his enemy. So it makes sense that when he heard that David took out the country of Zobah, that he was like, yes, awesome, I don't have to fight these people anymore. And he's now excited about David. He loves this, and so he pursues good relations with David, even to the point of sending his son to congratulate him with a large gift. And guys, there's actually something interesting here. This is a good reminder that there are two reactions people can have to God's anointed king.
okay? They can resist him and be destroyed by him, which is what happened to most of the kingdoms that surrounded David. Or they could bow their knee to him and welcome him and be blessed by him. The choice was theirs, was it not? Right? They could make that choice. As a matter of fact, guys, Psalm 2, okay? Some of you are probably somewhat familiar with this one. It talks about the kings of the earth facing a choice to either resist David or welcome David as God's anointed king. If they resisted David, they would be destroyed. If they welcomed him, they would be blessed by him, as Toi, king of Hamath, had done. And in verses 10 through 12 of Psalm 2, listen to what David writes. He says, "Now therefore, O kings, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son, that he not become angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in him." Now, I'm sure you noticed something in David's words there. The New Testament tells us that Psalm 2 is not only about David as God's anointed king. This psalm ultimately points to Jesus. That's right. Jesus, God's ultimate anointed king. And the kings of the world will rebel against Jesus. They do now, and they will right before he returns again as well. Why? Because they hate him. It is that simple, okay? It is that simple. This is why the religious leaders wanted to crucify Jesus. They hated him. And today, guys, we should expect the posture of the people of this world to be hostile to Jesus. Hostile to his rightful rule over their life. My gosh, do we not see this every single night on the news? Right? It's the same thing. And just as resistance of the nations around Israel was futile, right? They could resist all they wanted, but God was helping David everywhere he went and in everything he did. It was futile because God had committed to David's success. Resistance to Jesus is also futile because God has committed to Jesus as the rightful king, his chosen king. Guys, Jesus won the right to rule the earth through the cross and through the empty tomb. And one day he is going to return to destroy his enemies. But Jesus doesn't come back to destroy everyone. He comes to bless all who, like Toi, king of Hamath, chose to take refuge in him. Do you see? Where are you at in this regard? Are you resisting Jesus, God's chosen king? If you are, and I'm not trying to be melodramatic here, but you need to know your rebellion and your resistance is futile. Futile? Futile? You know what I mean, right? It doesn't matter. You are not going to overcome him. Just as God was committed to David ruling, God is committed to Jesus ruling. Just as David destroyed God's enemies in the promised land, Jesus will destroy God's enemies on the earth. There is a choice to make, isn't there? There is a choice to make. We can choose to be Jesus' enemy, or we can choose to be his friend, you see. In verses 11 and 12, continue with exactly with what David did with all that tribute that was going to start rolling in to Jerusalem. Look at what it says there. King David also dedicated these to the Lord with the silver and gold that he had dedicated from all the nations which he had subdued. From Aram, that's the Arameans, and Moab, and the sons of Ammon, that one, we didn't even see that one, and the Philistines, and Amalek, there's another one that we haven't seen, and from the spoil of Hadad-Ezer, son of Rahab, king of Zoba. So all of the riches of David's defeated enemies
What did he do with it? Exactly. He willingly dedicated it to the Lord instead of putting it into his own personal bank account. Okay? Is this an important distinction? Matter of fact, guys, much of this great wealth that we're reading about right here is what Solomon will one day use to build the temple of God. But there's something to notice here. As we saw, David recognized that the amazing victories he experienced against all these powerful nations around him were victories God had given him. Yes? Right? We've seen that numerous times here. He did not win those battles on the basis of his strength. He did not win those battles on his cunning, David's military acumen, or any of those things. David was very aware that the great successes in his life all came from God. So, rather than hoard his wealth, which God is the one who had handed it to him, he gave it back to God in gratitude for how God had blessed him. Now, I recognize that we are not anointed kings of God in the way that David was. Okay? And I know that we're not battling the nations around us, at least not physically. I hope we're all doing battle spiritually in prayer, right? But not physically like this. But guys, like David, do you realize that every, as a child of God, every bit of success in your life comes as a gift from God? It is not by your own strength. You understand? That means God deserves credit, right? When God provides for our needs, when we're given a raise we didn't expect, or in whatever way, shape, or form God does it, what do we do with that newfound wealth? What do we do with that? Do we just keep it? Do we hoard it? Do we sock it away for a rainy day, putting our hope and trust in that to get us through the bad times in the future? Or do we worship God and give Him a portion of it? Now, guys, I understand that at this point, as a pastor, I am supposed to talk about tithing. So I will. But that is the obvious application here. But can I say this? First and foremost, this is not a discussion about tithing. This is a realization that any success we have in our life is a gift from God. That is just as difficult a pill to swallow for most Christians as tithing may be. Okay? But David knew. David knew that all of his successes were a gift from God. Remember, he didn't have horses. He was outgunned. He was overwhelmed. He was at fighting battles on two fronts, right? North and south. And in spite of all those overwhelming challenges, God gave him the victory. Out of gratitude, doesn't it make the most sense of anything for David to have honored God with a portion of the blessings that God had honored him with? I mean, does this make sense, doesn't it? When we look at it here with David, it makes sense. Guys, I have long felt that our reluctance to give back to God from the blessings that He has given us, it's not always an issue of greed or a lack of faith or not trusting God to provide. Guys, we need to understand, those who choose not to give God a portion of what He has given them may also inwardly be claiming that any success they have in their lives came from themselves, not from God. Do you begin to see a different way of looking at this issue? And in my mind, it's a much graver issue. When I start saying it's all up to me, it's all because of me, and oh sure, God's great and everything, but I'm handling all of this, He's not involved. Do you begin to see the problem? Particularly so for those of us who name the name of Jesus Christ. Okay? This is not me pounding the pulpit because we need to get money in the bank accounts. That's not it at all.
This is me banging the pulpit. Well, I haven't actually banged it yet. But this is me wanting you guys to understand that I believe a core issue in our issues when it comes to things like tithing is because we don't believe God did it. We think it's ours. We think it belongs to us. We think we earned it. And in fact, that simply is not the case for those who are believers in Jesus Christ. God is the one who is our provider. And so, as you were willing to admit with David, it makes the most sense. If God's the one who did it, that we honor the Lord by giving some of it back to Him. Guys, this is why this is such a serious issue. Okay? Tithing. The issue of money. The issue of giving. Okay? And so I encourage you, search your heart in that regard. Not in whether you should go put money in the box in the back. That's not what I'm saying. Search your heart in regard to whether you believe that everything you have is a gift from God. And whether you are honoring Him in that way. And guys, David's humility before the Lord in that regard led to many other good things for this new king. First of all, it led to David reigning in justice and righteousness. Look at verse 15. We're going to wrap this up here real quick. So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and righteousness for all his people. So we've seen David conquer the nations around him that were hostile to God. We've seen him expand the nation of Israel very nearly to the borders that God originally gave them. And we have seen David bring the wealth of the nations into Jerusalem, which will later be used to build God's temple. And now we see how David administered his kingdom. And guys, for those who had lived through the reign of King Saul, what David's doing right here would have been shocking, and it would have been so incredibly refreshing, wouldn't it have been? David administered righteousness and justice to his best friends. Is that what it says? What's it say? To all people. Saul gave some pretty nice perks to people he liked who were on his good side, right? But not David. David's kingdom was not run like our government today, guys. Okay? It was just. It was fair. He refused to play favorites. He did not allow dirty politics. He did things the right way. The just way. And once again, I get a kick out of this. David wrote a psalm about it. You believe that? Psalm 101 is a worship song that described the way David ran the nation. Israel had fascinating songs of worship, did they not? Right? But it may sound like an odd basis for a song, but listen to verses 4 through 8 of Psalm 101. David says, "A perverse heart shall depart from me. I will know no evil. Whoever secretly slanders his neighbor, him I will destroy. No one who has an haughty look and an arrogant heart will I endure. My eyes shall be upon the faithful of the land, that they may dwell with me. He who walks in a blameless way is the one who will minister to me. He who practices deceit shall not dwell within my house. He who speaks falsehood shall not maintain his position before me. Every morning I will destroy the wicked of the land, so as to cut off from the city of the Lord all those who do iniquity." Can you imagine if the United States government adopted these verses as our new operating procedure in government? First of all, government would empty out real fast. Real fast, okay? But as you can see, David had zero tolerance for corruption, for backbiting, for people who were talking about other people behind their backs, for people who were slandering the name and reputations of others. He had no patience with those who maybe on one hand looked pretty good, but their hearts were proud and arrogant. I think it's safe to say he had incredibly high standards for the leaders of his country. And while what David says here may sound a bit harsh, right? Every morning I will destroy, right? That sounds a bit harsh to our ears. You know what the result was? The result was a kingdom where justice
and righteousness could actually flourish. Not just be chatted about theoretically or hypothetically from pulpits at our, you know, Democratic and Republican conventions. It could actually happen. What a novel idea. That's what we see here. Which, of course, had a great impact on who he surrounded himself with in leadership. He surrounded himself with people of integrity. Read the last couple verses with me, verses 16 through 18. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. We met him already. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests, and Sariah was secretary. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and David's sons were chief ministers. So, first of all, I'm not going to go through all of these right now. We're going to meet all of these people as we continue on through 2 Samuel, okay? But David surrounded himself with good people. Now, please understand, I am not saying that any of these people here were perfect. I would say that's a pretty good, obvious guess, right? They're not perfect. And like I said, we'll get to know them better as we move through. But even David wasn't perfect. That is going to be highlighted for us in a very grievous way in just a couple chapters, okay? But what we see here is that David did not try to lead this country all by himself. He knew he needed a team around him, a team that fit the qualifications he laid out in Psalm 101. And I see that this is reflected, guys, in the Lord's instructions to the church when it comes to things like leadership. You know, think about King Saul, right? We saw King Saul basically either tried to run everything himself, or he surrounded himself with dubious people who did not have integrity or loyalty, okay? David learned from that bad example, so should we, okay? Nowhere in the New Testament are we told that churches are to be led by one individual. Nowhere, okay? We are told that they are to be led by a plurality of elders and deacons, a group of people. And, by the way, we are also given a laundry list of qualifications for those church leaders. I'm not going to go into all of that tonight. I put the references in your outlines, but you can go read 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 7, Titus chapter 1, verses 5 through 9. We got a list of qualifications for church leaders, okay? And they all revolve around two things that were on David's list as well: integrity and loyalty. Right? Uprightness in their life and loyalty to God and loyalty to God's church. If those two things are true in a person's life, then God can bless them and God can use them to lead his people. Which he's exactly what he did with this list of people that David assembled. But if that is not true in those people's lives, no matter how skilled they may be, no matter how charismatic they may be, God will not bless them, and God will not choose them to lead his church. It is that cut and dry. And God's standards and God's will in leading his people today have not changed from what he desired when David was king. God has not changed his opinion on these things. Now, of course, these are a pale reflection of what God's ultimate anointed king will be like. Yes? Right? Just as David destroyed those who resisted God's kingdom, but blessed those who welcomed it, Jesus will do the same. Jesus, when he returns, will destroy those who resist him, his kingdom, and save those who welcome it. Just as the wealth of the nations was brought into Jerusalem by David, the wealth of the nations will be dedicated to Jesus and brought into Jerusalem during his 1,000-year reign upon this earth, and for that matter, in the new Jerusalem, in the new creation, in the new heavens, in the new earth. Just as life in the promised land brought glory to David, as we read, God's chosen king, life in the new creation, guys, it's going to be all about the glory of Jesus. All of it. God's chosen king. And just as David reigned with righteousness and justice in a world of corruption, Jesus is the one who will reign with righteousness and justice, both on this earth and for all eternity in the new creation. So, guys, my point here is that every single day when you and I see all the corruption in our government, when you and I see all the junk going on in this world, let that set your hope on eternity, where Jesus will be in charge. He's in charge now, but he hasn't chosen to act on it yet. Right now, he's waiting for those to willingly come to him. But there will come a day when he says, we're done now, and he returns. I'm encouraging you as followers of Christ, if you are, to set your hope there. Not in anything this world offers, not any of your chariots or horses that you might have at home socked away. Put your trust in him, and your trust will be rewarded. Your trust will be answered. In that day, guys, you and I are going to love our government. We're going to love it because Jesus is going to rule with justice and integrity and fairness and compassion. Amen? Would you pray with me? Father,